Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host for this evening, Ethan Elkind. If you were a teenager in the 1980s or 90s, you probably remember Tabitha Soren. Gen Xers know her as the spirited redheaded girl who appeared in a Beastie Boys video and scored interviews with an impressive list of politicians and big-name musicians. She covered the 1992 and 1996 presidential elections and was the face of MTV's Choose or Lose campaign, which encouraged the younger generation to get out and vote. Her interviews were so iconic that she became something of a celebrity in her own right. But today, Tabitha spends most of her time looking through the lens of a camera, having turned her passion for photography into a successful second career. Her photographs have been featured in magazines and museums across the country, and in recent years, her acclaim as an artist has been growing. Her show Running exhibited in Los Angeles in 2013 and soon in New York City. And this year alone, she has two major projects centered in our very own Bay Area. Her show Surface Tension opened recently at Uquinon Projects at the Minnesota Street Project in San Francisco, and she also just came out with a new book. Entitled Fantasy Life, Baseball and the American Dream, it tells the story of a group of minor league draft picks for the Oakland A's, made famous in the book Moneyball, who Tabitha followed and photographed over a period of 14 years. Here tonight to discuss her career path, her new projects, and what they tell us about baseball and life, we are pleased to be joined by Tabitha Soren. Welcome, Tabitha.
Hi, Ethan.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. We'll open the phone lines in just about 20 minutes, and you can reach us then by dialing 415-841-4134. If you want to contact us right away, you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. If you have a question for Tabitha Soren, please do reach out. So, Tabitha, let's start from the early days of your career. So you definitely made a lot of headlines and were part of a lot of the big political movements as a political reporter at MTV, and a lot of folks in my generation, the Gen X, certainly remember you for that. What made you interested in becoming a political reporter and working for MTV, and how did that opportunity come about?
Well, I grew up watching MTV. I lived all over the world and in some places in the United States where the only cool music was on MTV. I remember the first video I saw, actually. It was an AC/DC concert video. For those about to rock, we salute you. Terribly boring video, but for the first time ever seeing that during the daytime, because there were these nighttime shows that had videos. So I was living on the Gulf Coast of Florida, and the only music we had access to was FM, you know, album-oriented radio playing the same Led Zeppelin songs over and over again. So to see all this, I mean, the AC/DC isn't a very good example, but a lot of the music on MTV at that time was all videos from Top of the Pops in England, and I had never heard of most of those bands. So I was a fan of MTV very early. But it was a very religious neighborhood and community where I lived, and I mean, they affectionately refer to it as the Redneck Riviera. And the Christian, I don't know if they were a coalition at that time, but they got the cable company to remove MTV, and we all protested to get it back. So that was kind of my first political act.
They were the moral majority back then. And then
yeah,
they later
something
became,
like that, exactly.
Yes.
Because I lived all over the world, I was exposed to, you know, Ferdinand Marcos when I lived in the Philippines, and they were our downstairs neighbor in Germany was a former Nazi. So I was exposed to different cultures that had bigger problems than the United States does in terms of their politics. And so even though I don't remember our family talking a lot about politics, my dad was in the Air Force, so it was just in the air. It was part of the fabric of my life. And also, by moving around, you are constantly the new kid in school, so you are very quick to learn what the rules of the community are, how to be liked, who the best people are to be friends with. You're constantly got your antenna out to sort of figure out how the community works. And having to do that every 3 years or so, I think, made me a very good reporter because I could land basically anywhere and figure it out very quickly. And I was used to communicating who I was as a human being to strangers over and over and over again. And so between MTV being something that I liked and political exposure to different kinds of political systems, plus not being afraid to talk to strangers, I think you roll those together and you end up with my career.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that opportunity come about? Was that something you auditioned for, or did you have someone you knew who was in a position to tell you about it?
I need to figure out a way to tell this story in a shorter way. But when I went to NYU, and in my freshman year, I interned at CNN, and the person I worked for at CNN recommended me for a paid job at MTV when I was a sophomore in college. I worked there periodically during the summers. I wrote Headbangers Ball 1 year. I associate produced some movie specials. You know, I also waitressed, but between the two, I could come up with enough money to live in New York during the summers. And then I graduated from college and took a job at ABC in Vermont, in Burlington. I covered the State House there. So once I was in Vermont, I'm really not an outdoorsy person. Me and Kamau Bell are the only people in the East Bay that admit that the you know, we don't like the outdoors. It's not a very popular sentiment, but that's the way we feel. And I think that I got very depressed in Vermont because it's obviously a very bucolic place and people love the foliage and all these things that I just did not appreciate. So I moved back to New York City and just decided I'll do whatever I need to do to live there because I felt like my people were there, and that's where I felt really at home. And I hadn't had a home until that point because I'd moved all over the world. And then things fell into place. Mm-hmm. So I got a freelance job. Somebody got sick. Kurt Loder wanted to go on vacation. It just was really sort of serendipitous. I happened to be working there anyway, doing behind-the-scenes stuff. And when John Norris got promoted, when he got promoted, Kurt Loder lost his substitute. Kurt was supposed to go on vacation. They weren't going to tell Kurt he couldn't go on vacation. And so Kurt said, why don't you have Tabitha audition? She used to read the teleprompter in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And
so things came together in a really nice opportunity.
Exactly when I wasn't pushing for it.
And it seems like MTV up to that point, as you mentioned, it was AC/DC videos, Top of the Pops, it really became a political force in terms of journalism at that time. And you had an opportunity to interview presidential candidates, as we mentioned in the opening, you know, 92, 96 election. Was there particular moments that you sort of look back on and think that was really something that you know, special, that stood out? I mean, do you have a sort of fond memory from those days as a political journalist?
Well, special doesn't necessarily mean fond, right? Mm-hmm. So when I interviewed George H.W. Bush on the back of a moving train a few days before the 92 election, that felt really important, but it wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. And I felt like he was a bit condescending, but I also felt like I had my follow-up questions really at the tip of my tongue, and I got them out, and I felt like I had been able to overcome the distraction of the moving train and the people waving and him drinking his coffee and the airplanes overhead and the cold. But there was also a town hall that we did with candidate Clinton, the very first one in Los Angeles, and that was supposed to be only an hour, and they extended the time period to 90 minutes because it was going so well. And at that point, I felt like we were on to something because there was such excitement in the air, and I felt like the people in the audience who asked the questions were really smart about it, and I was just there to ask the follow-ups in case they didn't have, you know, the research at their fingertips the way I did. I remember saying to my news director when we discussed doing it in the very beginning, you know, what would it take to have MTV News cover the campaign? And he said, well, I'd have to have somebody who was really excited to do it. And I said, well, that would be me. And so we tried it. And then the next step was, well, is the audience excited to see it? Mm-hmm. So it can't just be, you know, some chick out there pursuing her own interests. Mm-hmm. And when the audience responded so positively, that was really great, because then Viacom put a lot of money behind it. They got different advertisers. They got older advertisers that they hadn't had before, like telephone companies and car companies. And then we had buses and we had voter registration drives, and it just kept expanding and expanding. And it was hectic and it was very noisy, but I feel like they accomplished a lot.
It seems like every generation we kind of need that kind of, you know, popular entertainment type outlet like MTV to get young people engaged in politics the way that MTV was able
well,
to do at
I think,
that time.
I think Obama did a very good job of that in his first presidential election, and he didn't have an sort of entertainment company with him. He just adopted the internet.
Mm-hmm. So, like I said, it's candidate-driven, too, and Bill Clinton also was big on outreach to the younger generation. And was that that town hall where the boxers or briefs question
that
was asked?
That question was a later town hall. That was during I'm pretty sure that was during a crime gun control town hall that mm-hmm. we did when they were trying to push the crime bill forward.
Mm-hmm. But either way, you definitely have headlines coming out of MTV-type forum that maybe you wouldn't have if it was a more traditional forum, I guess. I mean, it's hard to imagine someone asking that question, boxers or briefs, of a presidential candidate at a non-MTV.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it was for me, what it showed about candidate Clinton was that he could roll with the punches. I thought that was actually useful to see. The question is funny. Yes, he could have been thin-skinned about it or not taken it as a joke or, you know, replied in some sexual manner. Mm-hmm. But I thought he just handled it exactly the right way. And I thought that that body language and that communication and the way he thought very quickly on his feet, I thought that told you a lot more. That's where television, you know, is really the medium that you want. Mm-hmm. So you can analyze all the body language as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that humanized him to some extent, I think. So, all right, so this is your MTV years. You helped put, you know, MTV on the map in terms of its political involvement. So then what happened after that? You made this big shift now, career shift to photography. What was sort of the interim step there? Or was there an interim step?
There was an interim step. So after the 96 campaign, I was pretty burnt out. I had just met my future husband, and I felt like I wanted to slow down a bit. So I applied for a night fellowship at Stanford. It's a journalism fellowship that pays you your salary for a year to go to Stanford, and there's one at Harvard as well. And when I moved out here, I just thought the standard of living was so much better than what I was dealing with in New York City. And I really had, I mean, I celebrated my 18th birthday, I think, at CNN. So I had been doing journalism for a very long time. And when I applied to the Knight Fellowship, I thought that I would learn more about documentary filmmaking and expand in that direction, because I didn't really like the way my career was progressing. It was getting more and more successful, and the audiences were getting bigger and bigger. But that also requires it to get more and more mainstream. And we didn't have the lovely niche programming that you have now because of the internet and podcasts and all the rest. So I didn't know what to do about that. I was on the Today Show. I was supposed to be bringing in audience members who were my age, yet, you know, appealing to the 65-year-old people who were also watching. And I just felt my scripts were getting more and more watered down, and there wasn't much nuance or subtlety. And so when I got to Stanford, I researched and worked with a lot of documentary filmmakers and realized that half their time is spent fundraising. And that is just not something that I am good at, nor do I want to do. So I think I wandered into the art history department and never left.
Mm-hmm. I guess the fundraising piece is sort of the downside of the niche type environment that we have now. I mean, if you're getting kind of tired of the mainstream piece of
that's
it,
true.
The flip side is that it's harder to get that support and maybe
good
reach
point.
The audience.
Yes, I was totally spoiled in that somebody would give me $250,000 to do a 28-minute show, and I didn't have to fundraise. I just had to spend the money and not go over budget. So. Mm-hmm. Certainly, that is not the case for most places today.
So you wanted to move into documentaries still on the subject of politics, or was just any type of documentaries that you were interested in at that point?
I wanted to have more time to be able to do things more in depth. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't limit myself to politics, and I didn't at MTV. I did a documentary on pornography. I did a documentary on guns. I did a documentary. So, I mean, those are political in a general sense, but it's not Washington, D.C. politics, or it's not centered strictly on laws and policy. Mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in, you know, sort of social criticism, I suppose. But where I really felt the most pleasure was in the dark room at Stanford. And I had really encouraging teachers who I'm sure they were not as excited about my work as much as they made me feel they were. But it was terribly encouraging. Bob Dawson, Joel Levick, Alex Nemirov was an amazing art history professor who would, you know, do a reading of a picture that I took and make me feel like, you know, it could be in a museum. And I'm sure they weren't worthy of all of that attention, but it made me believe in myself, and that's what every student needs, even if you're 30.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a vision for your career as a photographer, or was it just sort of, I'm enjoying this, and let's just kind of, you know, see where this goes?
I remember it being hard to tell my friends what I really wanted to do. I felt a little embarrassed by wanting to pursue art photography as a career. It seemed like something that was just out of my reach. Mm-hmm. But I just kept doing it because it made me happy. So I wasn't thinking, for once in my life, I was not thinking about a career, but only probably because I was too insecure.
Well, were you envisioning a kind of an impact that you might have with the photography?
I definitely was not thinking about any social, political aspect of it. The last thing I wanted to do was document the underclass or homeless people or interview politicians. If I was going to do that, it was going to be on television. Mm-hmm. I wanted a separation from nonfiction almost.
And so let's talk about this book, Fantasy Life. And can you just describe how the book came about and the basic structure of the book?
Sure. The book came about after 14 years of shooting relentlessly. I followed the 2002 draft class from their first spring training, which confusingly is in 2003. All baseball fans will understand that. So I met 21 members of the draft class who I felt like would be good photographic subjects. And I was really shooting them because I thought that their faces and bodies would change over time, like anyone's does. But their physique was so pronounced, and they were about to be all successful Major League Baseball players. In my ignorant opinion, I thought they were all inevitably going to be playing for the major leagues. I didn't realize only 6% of them would. And I felt like maybe you'd be able to see in their eyes when they became a commodity, or how success changed them, or if once they got money, they were disappointed. Or I had had a little experience with a small amount of fame, and I just thought it was interesting that it doesn't always hit you the way you expect it to. It doesn't supply you with the fortification that you assume it will. And the project became very different than what I had in mind in the beginning. And I certainly didn't have in mind that I would follow these guys for 14 years, because I don't even really like baseball. I was interested in them as human beings, and I knew they were trying to make a name for themselves in baseball. But what I eventually figured out, I really was interested in how they were going to sort of reorient their identity after baseball, because so many of them were getting released, and I just didn't expect that to happen so fast, because these are guys who were stars of their little league team. They were stars of their high school team. They won the Johnny Bench Award or the, you know, All-Star Pitching Award in college. They were drafted by a major league team. What do you mean they're not actually going to be able to play? If not them, who? You know, I couldn't believe the number of people who are funneled into this minor league system who are there actually just for a cup of coffee. So it was really like an anthropologist going into a subculture that they knew nothing about. And my husband wrote the book Moneyball, and Billy Bean allowed me, the manager of the A's, allowed me to have access that other photographers didn't have, probably because I wasn't after any sort of scoop or gotcha moment. And it really became the thing that kept me going over the years was not so much the home runs and the double plays. It was the question of why this means so much to people and how is this so wrapped up in the American dream and why you watch this. It's a very slow, quite boring game at times. It can seem very long. And, you know, it's not like football where you have all of that gladiator, those bodies crushing each other and the violence and or the balletic aspect of basketball that's moving so fast and so many things to watch. So I just really, for years, was scratching my head. But, you know, the more time I spent in the environment, the more I got from fans what was going on and how it related to Manifest Destiny and some of these larger themes in American life. Plus, I got very attached to the players. So if they were playing, I was rooting for them, and that was very exciting.
Mm-hmm. So lots of questions to ask you, but first...
That was a long answer.
Yeah, that raises a lot of important
14 years
questions.
Is a long time to stew on something.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, it reminds me a lot of the movie Boyhood. That, you know, you're tracking, in this case, you know, in the movie's case, actors, but you sort of knew that going in that you were going to do this long-term tracking of the players. But let me take a quick station break here. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, I'm in conversation with Tabitha Soren, whose new book, Fantasy Life, tells the photographic stories of a group of minor league draft picks for the Oakland A's. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments, and we're opening the phone lines now. Are you curious about Tabitha's career shift from political journalist to photographer? Do you have questions about her new book, her approach to photography, or any of the projects she's been describing tonight? The number to call to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So as I was just mentioning, it reminds me a lot of that movie Boyhood. And when you were starting this project, did you have a certain time frame in mind? I mean, did you ever think this was going to be 14 years?
No. If I had asked Billy Beane if I could hang around for 14 years, I'm sure he would have said no, even to me. Mm-hmm. So it just was something that evolved. The pictures were turning out. The minute I decided it wasn't about baseball, the project, the better the pictures got.
Mm-hmm. And you made an interesting comment, which is that you had experienced fame, and I think it sounds like from what you're saying, a lot of why you wanted to move into photography was to sort of get out of that type of world to some extent. And how much of this was watching these players, knowing that some of them would have to grapple potentially with that fame? It sounds like you sort of came in thinking they were all going to, you know, at the time you didn't know how bit of a long shot it was.
Exactly.
Was that part of it for you, to kind of see what fame does to people?
I was not conscious of it while I was shooting. It's only in the last 6 weeks of doing all of these interviews about the book that it dawned on me that their second act was happening while I was trying to get together a second act as well. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty absorbed in learning all of the technical aspects of photography, plus figuring out a way to take these pictures of this pastime that has been photographed endlessly, and I wanted to do it in a way that had my stamp on it and not be imitating or repeating something that was already out there. So there wasn't a lot of navel-gazing on my mm-hmm. part. I was at times I was definitely overwhelmed. It was definitely trial by fire, and there were 21 of them, and I was chasing them all over the country. So there wasn't a lot of, how does this project relate to me? And I'm, you know, that the pictures are probably better for it. But definitely there are some similarities.
Mm-hmm. And I'm struck also, seeing some other comments you made about this project, that, you know, you were not a baseball fan, and you talked about how, that wasn't what necessarily drew you to the project. How do you think not being a baseball fan changed your perspective to do a project like this? I mean, I would think someone who really loves the game might try to look for those action shots. You know, it's very focused on strategy and the athleticism. Did you find that it gave you an advantage in some ways, not being that interested in the details of the game itself?
I think not being a fan allowed me to leave the game and walk around the stadium and get a sense of what was going on out there and notice little details like the gum on the floor of the dugout with tobacco stuck in it and not really knowing what that is and then being grossed out once I discover with my lens what I'm actually taking a picture of, instead of watching the double plays or the home runs. There definitely was a way that I could extricate myself and not be distracted by, you know, the incredible athletic prowess on the field. The other professional sports photographers who were at the same games were often, you know, teasing me that my camera was always pointed the wrong way whenever something really exciting was happening. And part of that is because I had a different thing that I was going after. But part of that is also that they knew so much about the game, they could almost anticipate what was going to happen. And that's the only way they can do their job. And they were so generous at times. So they would say, oh, you know, you're shooting Jared Burton. And I said, yeah, you know, he's in the bullpen right now, but they're going to bring him in. And they'd say, oh, you better get over to the other well. And I was, what are you talking about? Well, the light is behind him if you're standing over there. So And you know, the Major League stadiums are huge, so I had to pack up all my equipment and run halfway across the stadium to get in the right position for him to throw, I don't know, 9 pitches. When my third act is going to be being a relief pitcher, because if you prorate how much of those people make based on per pitch, it's incredible. So by the time I got the camera set up, I'd get like 3 shots off, and then he was done for the night.
Yeah. So if you're sort of doing Moneyball from the player's perspective, then the most efficient way to make the most money is to be a reliever.
Seems that way. Yeah. I mean, good Lord.
Maybe a left-handed reliever, too. So question for you then on some of the players that you featured here. Can you give us, you know, give the listeners some, you know, a couple of the players that kind of really stood out to you in tracking their lives? I mean, some of them had great success, like Nick Swisher, but some of them really fell on some hard times. Can you describe those sort of the sort of polar opposites there?
Sure. It's good to have that kind of direction, because if you just ask me to highlight a couple of them, it makes me feel like I'm choosing between my children. Mm-hmm. They've all got really interesting, complicated stories. But Nick Swisher definitely is the most famous. He made $98 million in the I think 12 years, maybe 14 years that he played.
And he was, I think, Rookie of the Year for the Oakland A's when he first came up.
Yes, he was an All-Star. He's got a couple of World Series under his belt. I think that he's a very good example of somebody who the media loved, and he's a great person to take a picture of because I have to ask him sometimes to not smile, but he's really game for anything. He would do push-ups before a shoot to make his muscles pop, and would let me shoot him even doing the push-ups. So he, you know, he was great in his openness and forthcomingness. But he's a good example of somebody who got to the Cleveland Indians. He's from Ohio, so that was like a homecoming. They made a big publicity stunt out of it, $56 million over 5 years, and then his knees gave out. So he is – and that is uncomfortable if you are on the injured list and you're sitting on the bench with all these people who are working their butts off and you're not playing, yet you have the entire payroll in your pocket. Like, that was not a comfortable dugout to be in. And it's not Nick's fault. I felt like in this case, he is the best example of really the biggest issue that this project grapples with, as does the rest of my work. And it's the fact that we are all living and dying at the same time. And he is the perfect example of that, because his knees just gave out. Is that his fault? Did he do anything wrong? Has he not been working as hard as he possibly can all these years? It's just a matter of time. And yes, a lot of people have injuries along the way, but I mean, his was just age, and it's something we can't prevent. And how you deal with that crisis is a real test of character. And in this case, for all of these guys, not just Nick, but having to figure out how to go through life without the one thing that has given it meaning since the time you were 5 is a huge test. And that was what I was sticking around to see. Mm-hmm. So another one of my...
Wanted to ask you about Nick. Because you said how he's so smiley and, you know, really love to ham it up for the camera. At this later stage, did that change? I mean, did you actually see that affect him?
He's still a puppy. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's still, like, bouncing off the walls. He's got kids now, so he has 2 kids. They're happy-go-lucky. So is he.
So it didn't affect him. I mean, he had
resilience. Yeah, I mean, it definitely, you know, he could calm down and you could have a serious discussion with him. But in general, how does he wake up in the morning? It's a sunny day in Nick's world. Mm-hmm. And some people have, you know, I don't know if it's a serotonin level or what chemistry is going into that, but it's not fake. Mm-hmm. It is not just when the camera's on.
Yeah.
And yes, I'm sure he has a temper and can get angry and all of that. I know his wife. He's not, you know, inhuman.
Yeah.
But he's also not a phony.
Mm-hmm. So that was on the sort of successful end.
Yeah, he's my most successful.
Yeah.
And he was destined to be successful. I mean, he had swagger when he was 4 years old. He used to play wiffle ball with a giant pink bat and did not feel like his masculinity was threatened one iota. Mm-hmm. His father was also a famous baseball player. So he was somebody, you know, whose destiny sort of implied that he would be successful too.
So I want to ask you about the other extreme of that you covered. But before we get into that, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, I'm talking to Tabitha Soren, whose new book, Fantasy Life, tells the photographic stories of a group of minor league draft picks for the Oakland A's. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So, back to the subject of the other extreme, given that you're, you know,
well,
covering a range of players.
So the person who comes to mind is named Mark Kiger, and he is not the person who did the worst in terms of baseball. There were people in my group who never got out of single A, and Mark was not one of those. He played, I think, in the postseason for the Mets, for the big leagues. He had times where he was called up. But he was somebody who had no financial cushion when he grew up. He had a very hard upbringing and really has gotten everywhere he has been on his own. And baseball was no different. And Billy Beane, I remember him telling me that Mark was his favorite type of player because he had nothing to lose. This guy had no plan B. And he didn't like school, and he partied hard, and he spent all his money in baseball on big fancy cars and just really lived the major league lifestyle before he was part of the major leagues. And so when he was released, he had no money. He went into debt. He couldn't find a job. He lived out of his car. Both his parents died. I mean, it was just a real terrible period. And he has worked himself out of that situation by going to a sober living facility. And he has his own apartment. And he moved to where his ex-wife and kids are in Texas so he can be a good dad. And piece by piece, he's put his life back together. But you don't envision somebody who was this athletic star for his whole life, who got drafted by a major league baseball organization, ending up homeless.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, between him and Nick, there's all different stories in between.
Yeah.
But certainly some of them had played much worse than Mark Kiger. He was not, you know, he got injured. He didn't have the best luck with trades that happened on his teams. I mean, so much of this has nothing to do with the skill level of the people involved. One of my guys, Mark Tian, was a third baseman his whole life, and then Eric Chavez's contract got renewed, and so Billy traded Mark, even though he loved Mark, but he didn't need him because they both played the same position.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Mark went to the Kansas City Royals and had a pretty good period there. But, you know, he ended up being on there's a show happening of mine at City Hall this year that starts in July. And one of the things I'm doing is I had each of the players write down a list of the teams that they were on and how long they were on each team. And Mark's list is incredibly long. It includes being on the San Francisco Giants for spring training. It's got another team he was on for 10 days, another team he was on for just one day. And you can't tell me that somebody is going to play well under those circumstances where you're just rotating through these dugouts. And you know, I am told by my husband all the time when I complain about the amount of family time we sacrifice for all my children's sports careers and Little League and softball and swimming and basketball, and it just goes on and on and on. And he said, you know, they're learning cooperation and team collaboration, and they're working for something bigger than themselves, and all of these ideas about sports that are character driven. And I can't say that I saw that with the people who were traded so much. Yeah. I don't, you know, they don't know each other. They're not acting like a team because they just got there. Yeah. I can't tell you how many pictures of trucks that I have in empty parking lots where the player was traded and had to get to the other team so fast that he had to leave his truck in the parking lot of the former stadium. His wife had to fly in and drive the truck. They all have trucks. Mm-hmm. Nobody doesn't have a truck. Yeah. To the player and wherever he ended up. It was not unlike the military.
Yeah, it seems like there is that sort of the dark side of that game that, you know, you hear reference, but you really had a chance to see that up close.
I'm sure it's different for the Derek Jeters of the world.
Yeah.
But there aren't that many of those.
They're not representative, right? So you've got players in the minor leagues who are really more representative of where people who try to make it professionally are going to end up.
In Mark Tian's case, it was actually in the major leagues where all of this horse trading was going on. So, I mean, Joe Blanton is somebody who was part of my draft class, and he's still playing. And he retired a few years ago, decided he was going to run a winery, had a really bad outing with the Angels, and just said, you know, this is awful. And I would read this press about him when he was playing for the Angels, and I would just wince. It would hurt me, you know, being labeled the worst pitcher in baseball, et cetera. So he just said, enough of this. I got plenty of money. I got three kids. I'm happy with my wife. I'm going to do something else. I have this other passion. And then he started playing catch with the guy next door. Presumably it must be a famous catcher, but he's never told me who it was. But his next door neighbor needed somebody to pitch to him. So he just started tossing balls to him, and he rediscovered his childhood love of the game. And then he got a tryout for the Pirates, and all of a sudden I'm at the gym and I look up. I said, God, that looks like Blanton on the mound, but he retired. What in the world? And he was playing for the Pirates, and then he got traded to the Royals, and then he went to the World Series. So
you probably thought you were done with the project.
I definitely had checked him off. Yeah. I mean, he had sent me his list. And then I had to go back and I had to write in, you know, that he had played for these other teams. And then he played for the Dodgers last season, and he was amazing until the postseason. And I mean, that it's so rare that it happens that you are playing well and you're on a good team. Having those two things line up is really, really great. Well, and I was so happy that it happened for him at age 36.
Mm-hmm. And it was quite a draft class that your husband's book made famous in Moneyball. I mean, the number of players, I mean, I guess three or maybe four, three players went on to the major leagues from that.
Out of 21. So
I guess it was three out of that, the first round draft picks. They had seven first round draft picks.
I'm out of my depth already.
But I remember one player, Jeremy Brown, who Moneyball made famous, was a great line about him that he was so basically poor as a catcher that if he wore corduroys, he might start a fire. That's what one of the scouts said about him. And I noticed he ended up being a coal miner.
Yep, he did. I mean, Jeremy is a great guy, but he really did not like being away from Hueytown, Alabama, where he's from. He did not like moving around all the time. I mean, the world of minor league baseball is just constant motion. And he's the only one of my group who voluntarily retired and was not released. He's the one that went to Billy and said, I got to stop doing this. I don't want to do it anymore. He loves baseball, but he didn't like the lifestyle exactly. Mm-hmm. So he actually was laid off from being a coal miner, and that encouraged him to go finish his college degree. And he got a teaching certificate, and now he runs, you know, sort of a travel ball program as well as teaching in high school.
How do these players feel about you photographing them? I assume you were pretty upfront about what you wanted to do.
Yeah, Jeremy's pretty shy, so I tried to tread lightly with him. Nick's a whole nother story. So each one of them is very different. But after a certain amount of years, they're just used to it. I think they consider me kind of strange. I mean, one of the players, Ben Fritz, had surgery. He got these bone spurs. He was a pitcher taken out of his elbow or shoulder. And when he got home from the surgery, they gave him the body parts that they had taken out. And his wife didn't want them. And he didn't want them, but he thought, well, maybe Tabitha wants them. And it actually turned out to be the start of me collecting spurs and teeth and other body parts that had been sacrificed for the game of baseball. And for the exhibit for Fantasy Life, I had this whole sculpture of all of these different white little chips of bone that became this celestial, basically a bunch of stars. Like you'd look up at the sky, I put it on dark blue velvet, and I kind of felt like, you know, there are more wishes than stars. That's what I thought about when I saw it. Some people just thought, ooh, that's gross.
Yeah.
But for me, it was really beautiful.
Well, and I noticed in a lot of these photos, you definitely sort of focus on this, the sort of the dark side of the game in a lot of ways. I mean, this, you know, the struggles, you know, behind the scenes, and even some of the physical, you know, the athleticism on the field is sort of the strain of it. I mean, that really comes through. And I would think that as an outsider to the game that you could maybe focus on that. As I said, you know, a little while ago, someone who loves the game might, you know, not sort of ignore that or might not even pick up on it. But did the players themselves pick up on that? I mean, did you feel that that was wearing them down, or was that just something that you observed about the sort of context that they were operating in?
I always had fun with them, even if as I was shooting their struggle. So, you know, they had their tantrums and they were pissy after they lost or grumpy, or we'd sit around and watch TV and they wouldn't say much, or there were definitely some emotionally dark moments, but they were just used to having me around. But when I was watching that struggle, that striving for greatness, I wasn't only thinking about baseball players. I wasn't only thinking about Ben and Jeremy and Jared. I was thinking about Americans in general and how we really all push ourselves. It is totally seen as our destiny to be number one. And there are many countries where that their idea of happiness and success is the antithesis of that. They want to blend in, like Japan and Australia. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but we normalize this incredible amount of striving and pushing and pushing and pushing, to the extent that I think we don't necessarily think about the outcome or what you're going to give up to get there. And if you're trying to beat the odds, you almost have to ignore that the odds exist, because if you know what the odds are, then it doesn't make rational sense for us all to get there. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking that way. Everyone told me I'm not going to find a job in television reporting, just because at that time everybody was trying to do it. And I was like, well, this is what I want to do, so I'm going to try anyway. And then when I was in Vermont, my news director at MTV, the guy who eventually put me on TV, said, you know, I could never put you on the air in New York. You're coming from the 99th market in Vermont. I can't put you on the number one market. I was like, fine, I'll work behind the scenes. I'll produce whatever you want to do. But it happened. So, I mean, sometimes you just have to ignore the logic, but you also have to be prepared for it not working out.
Yeah, it's that quest for the American dream, in an individualist kind of a way.
Yeah, what other country do you see people like with these foam fingers that say number one?
Number one.
You know, I mean, that's a bizarre...
And baseball is such an individual sport, too. I mean, everyone gets their
exactly.
moment in the sun. It's not
exactly.
It's teamwork.
Or not.
You're the person
who strikes out
yeah.
over and over. I mean, that's the thing. In soccer, they're all jumbled up, and you can't tell who didn't kick the ball right or, you know, who let it go.
But they own it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You don't catch that fly ball, the entire stadium's eyes are locked on you.
Mm-hmm. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight I'm in conversation with Tabitha Soren, whose new book, Fantasy Life, tells the photographic stories of a group of minor league draft picks for the Oakland A's. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Well, I'm struck by what you just said there about how this is in so many ways a metaphor for people's dreams that they're pursuing, even when it seems like it's against the odds. And it seems like in baseball, you really see that it's such a, you know, you actually have the numbers on how many people can make it. And, you know, I've often thought with baseball players that, you know, if they don't have anything else kind of going on in their lives, maybe there's no downside to them pursuing it. You mentioned that one player who, you know, who, that was all he had was baseball. Were there other players, though, who, you know, you felt like in their quest, it really took something out of them to spend that time going for the dream of baseball?
I would say the singularity of focus is totally consistent with my group. I mean, maybe when they get to the majors and they have money, they can develop a passion for wine in the case of Joe Blanton. But until, I mean, when I met them, all of them cared mostly about baseball. Some of them were also very religious. So that was a passion in their lives. But for the most part, it was all baseball all the time. Mm-hmm. This is, I mean, for the most part, they look in the mirror and they only see baseball player, which is why the transition out or bad injury or an operation that doesn't go right or a bad trade, it, all of that can just turn their career on a dime.
And just derail everything. Well, let's transition to another project that you have. I think it's maybe similar in theme to some extent, although not so much about the American dream, but Surface Tension, that's, as you mentioned, is showing at Yukonam Project at the Minnesota Street Project. That also has a lot of this you know, grappling with modern day stresses on people. It's an interesting project because it shows, I'm going to get all the technical stuff wrong, so I want you to describe
it. I'm sure I just got all the baseball technical stuff wrong, so have at it.
Well, since you actually know something about photography and I don't, I should let you describe it, but it's got a sort of unsettling feeling of background images with a sort of a front glass that's smudged. Can you describe a bit about how that came about and the process you use for that?
So since we're on the radio, I will describe it as if you look at your phone in the right kind of light, you will see all the marks of grime and traces of your fingertips on there. Basically, I'm taking a very close-up picture of that on a much larger screen. So I feel like the perfection of these devices and their oleophobic, oil-resistant design and their glabrous design, which makes them perfectly smooth, I feel like that's in direct opposition to us as human beings, that we have saliva and we sweat and produce oil and we're hairy and we have texture and... I think that the project is trying to bring those two aspects together. And again, it goes back to us living and dying at the same time. These devices do not have to deal with that contradiction, and we do. And I feel like the more time we spend with technology, it can almost make you feel physically inferior because you're not thinking as fast as a computer or not, you know, looking as slick as a computer or... it's not just computers. I mean, I think a lot of technology has shown us that it can outrun our expectations of what it does to us. I think obviously the nuclear bomb is the best example of that. Mm-hmm. So these pictures are meant to grapple with that conflict. I think there's a lot of good things that I get from screens, and I think there's a dark side too.
And I was struck by this feeling of kind of being removed from something. I mean, to have that in the way shows a bit of the distance and maybe a bit of the illusion that we have that we're actually just relating to the technology and not necessarily to what we think we're relating to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, behind it, the images and, you know, even the conversations that we're having behind it. Is that
absolutely? I'm definitely trying to highlight the humanity, and I'm also trying to. I mean, there's a bunch of different ideas going into a project. I work on these things for, you know, 3 or 4 years, so there's. I think the best projects have a lot of different ways into them. So there's not just one way to see it, but certainly the patterns that the fingers make on the screens are a map, I think, of how we spend our lives. It's like a GPS system almost, because how many times have you been on your computer for 4 hours or been answering emails on your iPad, and then all of a sudden 4 hours is gone and you think, oh my God, you know, where did the day go or what just happened or what did I do? If you shine your screen in a certain light, you can see all of the traces of where you've been, whether, you know, it's just been email, so there's a dots or swiping, which means, you know, you've changed a page in a book or a PDF. And I think that there's a nice sort of mystery map in each of the pictures.
Mm-hmm. And since we're on the subject of how you took these photos, can we go back to Fantasy Life and describe how you took those photos? Because I noticed there's, you know, some interesting techniques there.
So all the pictures in Fantasy Life they almost chronicle the history of photography from analog to digital. But when I went to take the so there's black and white shots, there's color shots, there's digital, there's film. But in addition to that, when I went to take the action shots, I really had a hard time figuring out how I was not going to just add to the glut of, you know, sort of Sports Illustrated, people sliding into home action pictures. And I discovered through research that an old photographic process called the tintype process came into the world 7 years before the first baseball contest. Not the game, but a contest. And so I figured since those two ideas came into the world at the same time, what if I mashed them together? So the action shots mostly are a view camera picture of a positive. There's no negative. You paint emulsion onto a metal plate, and then you expose the metal plate, and that's the picture. You can't make multiples of them. And they're dark and amber and not as crystal clear as a negative would be. But they've never been made before because the emulsion in the olden days was so slow that you could only do portraits. So they're very unique in the sense that they have actual action and moving, and I did that with a lot of lighting techniques and the subject's cooperation and sort of slowing down, maybe. Or,
and did you choose that part because of this historical connection to the birth of the game?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you get that.
I mean, I was definitely looking for a way out of not just taking another picture that could be on the cover of ESPN magazine.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about another photo series that you have called Running, which shows different people in different settings running, basically. Can you describe how that came about?
Yeah, that project is about the fight or flight response. So it's another situation that we all experience, the difficult twists and turns of just everyday living. It doesn't have to be the drama of getting released from a baseball team. And I feel like there is this moment where you can either, fight the situation or flee. And it happens so fast, and actually your eyes have a reaction, so you can't really see what's going on when you're in that state, and the time just slips by. So I wanted to take pictures of what that actually looked like.
And how did you stage these photo sessions?
I had people run wind sprints, basically. They're not running for very long distances, but they're running very fast and very short. So sometimes they would fall or trip, and none of them are models. They're just friends of friends or neighbors or what have you. And a lot of them are taken in the Bay Area.
And so you didn't give them any instructions to look frightened. I mean, and some of them
are
looking around.
No. I just had them run over and over and over until they got tired enough that they lost the self-consciousness that a non-model or non-actor has mm-hmm. when they're having their picture taken. I would suggest that to anybody who's trying to get a portrait of somebody not paying attention to you because they're worried about where their feet are going to go. And it really allows them to be less self-conscious. And it also opens the door for total happy accidents to happen because, yes, I can tell them where to run and I can find a location that has the light a particular way that I want it. And I can, here's the mark. I just run to that point. But they run faster than I expect. I run with them. There's a whole bunch of terrible things that happen and mistakes. But a lot of times I got something that I was not after, and it was way better than what I had originally set out to do.
Yeah, there's an unsettling feeling in watching it because you feel like you're seeing someone in this panic moment and something terrible is about to happen.
And so most of the time, those things go by too quickly. And that's I started out shooting film, but because these things were very fast and I had a huge flash and it needed to be very fast exposure, some of them in the show were film, but a lot of them I switched to digital just because it could be faster.
Mm-hmm. I want to switch gears and ask you about collaborations with your husband, Michael Lewis, who wrote Moneyball.
Sure.
So what was his involvement in fantasy life? I mean, besides obviously just getting you sort of exposed to these players and interested in following
them. I think his involvement was mainly encouragement. I mean, certainly if I had a question about baseball, he could answer it. But he didn't really have anything to do with the pictures other than telling me, this player has no strike zone or that person was drafted because of X, Y, and Z mm-hmm. because, of course, he knew all the statistics on every player in a way that I didn't have, I didn't even know where a strike zone would be. So there was one time where sometimes he tried to interview people because he was thinking about writing a second book about them. So he would sometimes come to my shoots and I this is so stupid, but I had this wonderful guy named Steve Stanley, who was part of a collaboration that we did for the New York Times Magazine. So maybe that's why we were together, because he wasn't around for many of the shoots. But because we have kids, so we just kind of try to not be both gone at the same time. But the New York Times Magazine had him write something about a couple of the guys and me take the pictures. And Steve Stanley was a great bunter. So Michael knew that, and he said, we should get a picture of him bunting. And I was like, okay. And so I stood on the mound, and Michael, you know, would throw him the balls, and then he would bunt. And I got some of the pictures going this way, but I didn't really like the background. So I'm standing on the mound. I'm like, okay, now let's do it that way. Because I'm not thinking that's where third base is. I'm just thinking, let's get a different angle. And Steve and Michael just, like, burst out laughing. Like, you're a moron. I'm not going to bunt that way. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. So sometimes the actual rules of the game and my photographic ideas did not mesh. Or the light was actually better that way, but it didn't matter because that would never happen.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, one of the things I talked about in Moneyball was Bill James, the great baseball statistician. He always says, you know, every strength is a weakness. So, you know, your lack of knowledge about baseball was a strength in some ways, and, you know, maybe created some challenges in others. So do you think that this book inspired your husband in terms, I mean, I would think it's unusual for him to have a subject that probably he would just, you know, maybe cover once, move on. Now all of a sudden, you know, within his family, he's now sort of tracking these the subjects of his book.
I think he's happy that I stuck around. He likes all the same people that I do. I think he's happy that we have long-term relationships with these guys, for sure. I think he likes that I feel artistically fulfilled. He likes that things are moving into place, that I'm just not, you know, taking pictures and of our kids and making him look at them. So I think he thinks it's good for me to be out in the world and have creative agency, or have agency over my creative expression independent of him. It's connected on some level because of Moneyball, but most of my work isn't.
And speaking of that, what's up on tap? We've only got a couple minutes left. I'm curious what you're working on now, or what big events you have coming up.
Well, I have so many shows planned that I have been mainly just printing and framing and planning. So that's not the most exciting part of the process for me, but it is nice to get it in a form that other people can see. So the City Hall show on July 20th, it will be up for 6 months. It has 9 feet by 7 feet images of the San Francisco Giants, a whole entire floor of San Francisco Giants, and then about 180 other pictures in the downstairs gallery from the book. And that's an awesome amount. I mean, awesome in terms of overwhelming amount of stuff to produce. So that's mainly what I've been working on.
So the listeners who want to see these photos in person, if not just on your website, come out to City Hall then.
It's free.
When is that going to be running?
It's free and open to the public. It goes on forever. It's July 20th through the end of the year. So anytime you go to City Hall for any reason, just ask where the Fantasy Life exhibit is and stop by.
All right, so mark your calendars. So that's City Visions for this evening. We're going to have to leave it there, but our guest tonight was Tabitha Soren, whose new book, Fantasy Life, tells the photographic stories of a group of minor league draft picks for the Oakland A's. Thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Thanks for having me.
That was a lot of fun. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show is produced by Chris Nooney. Join us next Monday as we discuss institutional racism with a panel of guests back here on City Visions. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.